Well, good morning. So Fernando gave a nice review of the background of millisecond pulsars and globular clusters, and I'm going to take on and discuss some work that's been done recently over the last 2 years or so, primarily using the Green Bank Telescope and the Arecibo Telescope. So we started some major searches using those two telescopes along with these collaborators. The big players are myself, Jason Hessels, and Ingrid Stairs, who've done the majority of the work for this project. But all the other people have played pretty crucial parts in various pieces. I'm going to go very quickly through this since Fernando already mentioned it. Millisecond pulsars have been known for about 20 years, and the recycled nature was that idea was brought up very early. And so very quickly, what happens is you have a binary system, you have the companion evolves, fills its Roche lobe, accretion happens, spins up the neutron star. During that time, it's thought to be the low-mass X-ray binary. And at the end of once accretion stops, you have a millisecond pulsar which turns on in the radio. And because of this and the binary nature of these systems and the recycling mechanism, it was thought the globular clusters must contain millisecond pulsars. And since they had a very large percentage of the low-mass X-ray binaries, that was another part of the argument. So people started to search these with great zest. And what happened is that it took very sensitive telescope, very deep observations, and very intense supercomputer time for Andrew Lyne and company in 87 to discover the first pulsar, and very soon after in 88 to discover the first binary. And you'll notice that very sensitive observations pushing the limits with this, with telescope sensitivities and with computational power, are very crucial aspects to finding these systems. Fernando did a nice job of summarizing the tremendous selection effects against finding these systems. And so there really are, especially the binary millisecond pulsars, which tend to make up the majority of these systems, they're tough nuts to crack. So as of about 2001, about 60 cluster pulsars were known, and the vast majority of those are the traditional millisecond pulsars with spin periods under about 20 milliseconds. So the question is, why did we undertake this big project and relook at these clusters, which had already been searched to death with Arecibo, and also, even though the Green Bank telescopes knew, the clusters had been searched before. And the bottom line is that a lot of great new science, which Fernando's kind of summarized, has come out of these systems. If you can have multiple MSPs in a single cluster, there's a lot you can do. Information, trying to get information about the cluster itself, a lot of information about the binary companions, and a lot of these systems are plain and simple exotic. Eclipsing systems, you can probe the what's going on with the companion. There's some very exotic systems like the highly eccentric system that Fernando mentioned. And then even more exotic systems have been predicted to exist. Sub-millisecond pulsars, pulsar black hole binaries, and possibly a pulsar-pulsar system. Stein, I know, has a bet. He thinks that someone's going to find a pulsar black hole system, and it's going to happen in a globular cluster. And so I'm taking him up on that bet, and I'm betting against myself, even though I really hope I'm wrong. So there's also some technical reasons as to why these searches have been done. Recent cluster searches that, just like Fernando was mentioning, have moved to a higher radio frequency than had been done earlier. Usually searches had been done at about 400 megahertz, or maybe 600 megahertz, where the effects of the interstellar medium are very, very drastic, and it even contributes more to the selection effects. But the great successes, along with the big upgrades in the Arecibo and the completion of the Green Bank Telescope, although it still has lots of problems, don't get me wrong, plus a dedicated large Beowulf system at McGill, and some new techniques that I developed over the last couple years to find very compact binary systems is what led us to this. And I'm just going to very briefly mention this one new technique, which has so far not found any new pulsars, but I'm not giving up hope. So very briefly, what happens, I mentioned you want long observations to get the maximum sensitivity, but some of these systems are in very compact binaries. So if you have a observation that say 8 hours at parks, which is, this is actually really real data, a 47 Tuck J from parks, and your pulsar is in an orbit that's only a couple hours, then you're going to get the pulse period that you measure or that you see in the Fourier transform is going to be moving in the Fourier transform. As a matter of fact, it oscillates back and forth with the orbital period. This generates this series of sidebands, and the interesting thing about these sidebands are that each of these points are periodic with the spacing of the orbital period. So if you take, in gray here, if you take a Fourier transform of this portion of your power spectrum, so Fourier transform to Fourier transform, you can actually detect the binary with a relatively strong signal at the orbital period. So it's a kind of a weird way to think to doing a Fourier transform of your Fourier transform. And this is, believe me, this is an unusual case. 47 Tuck J is very strong here. And in the type of systems I'm looking at, this comb type function would be buried in this noise. And this Fourier transform or the Fourier transform will still pick that out. And so we're still using these very long data sets to try to find these systems. So very briefly, we searched a whole bunch of clusters. The X's that are in red, the data has not been properly gone through yet. We have a whole bunch more clusters that we've taken data on this summer. And the bottom line is we have at least 9 new millisecond pulsars in 5 clusters, possibly another one in M80, which looks very real, but we cannot confirm it. And it's not real enough in our one detection that I'm going to claim it's there, but it may be real. The important part, though, once you detect these things, is to time them for long term, because that's where all the interesting science comes out. And so probably most of you are familiar with this, but just very briefly, the bottom line is we're counting for every single rotation of the pulsar over, hopefully, a several-year baseline, which gives us precisions in our measurements of various parameters of 10 to 15 significant figures. It's very common. These measurements of positions with, hundredth of an arc second positions are real. This is not some, voodoo. Well, it is voodoo, but it's real voodoo. So anyways, it's a tremendous precision, and that's what gives these MSPs their power in the clusters to bring out information, because you really have precision clocks in these in the center of your clusters. So briefly, let me just point out some of these new pulsars. Here's M5. Two of the pulsars, A and B, were previously known. The red circle is the core radius, and the black circle is the half-mass radius. The new pulsar that we've discovered is an eclipsing millisecond pulsar. Very fast spin rate and in a tight binary. This helps to explain why it wasn't seen in earlier searches. The selection effects, more computational power allows us to do fancier things. And yet it's right there in the center of the cluster. And we're actively timing this pulsar right now. M71, very low density cluster. But with Arecibo, which is a factor of 10 in sensitivity, greater than Green Bank, which is itself a factor of 2 or 3 greater than sensitivity than Parkes, you can really probe, as Fernando was saying, down into the luminosity distribution and find pulsars that we wouldn't otherwise have seen. So this is one pulsar within the core. It's also another eclipsing binary, 4-hour orbital period, about 5 milliseconds. And so this is the kind of thing that we're trying to comb and get out of our data now. Once we have a single pulsar, we know the dispersion measure of the cluster, and we can make much more, even more sensitive searches. So we're working on all that. One other pulsar in M30 is M30A, which I'll discuss just a teeny bit more in a little bit. But we have 3 eclipsing millisecond pulsars out of our 9 new ones. And so what you're seeing here is the time and observation as we go up this way. 2 pulse periods are shown. And obviously, you can see the intensity of the pulse radiation. And some interesting things, you can see definite eclipse. There's an eclipse here, here, and it's just going into eclipse again there. This is an 8-hour data set from Green Bank. Very nice eclipse here, and also here from Arecibo and M71. Those of you with sharp eyes can see a little bit of a curve in these trails here. And what that corresponds to, this is a blow-up of this section. And this is as the pulsar is going behind its companion and either going into or out of eclipse, the ionized wind from the companion is causing delays in the radio pulse. And so by using that, we can probe what's going on with the wind, the ionized wind, and probe the companion. And just briefly, for scientific, what we can tell is that all these systems are much bigger than any type of Roche lobe filling system. So the eclipse region is much larger than any type of reasonable star that can be in there. So it is definitely some kind of wind that's coming out. And one other thing I'll point out, Fernando mentioned the scintillation. M30 scintillates tremendously, and you can see here, it's relatively bright. This is a very weak pulsar to begin with, no matter what. But you can see even though there's an eclipse, it's very, very weak in the second half of the orbit. And even that part is a very strong detection for us in general. This pulsar is very tough to see on a daily basis. Once we have a timing positions and the timing solution for these, one of the very key parameters we get is the spin down rate, or the observed change in the pulse period. And we can do a lot with this. Now, from some work that Stirl Finney and some other people did in about 10 years ago. This pulsar spin period has numerous terms which it can be affected by. One of those is the intrinsic pulsar spin down. And then this term, two things, the galactic gravitational potential and the globular cluster gravitational potential, can affect the observed spin down, because it's just acceleration in that potential. And then this is a transverse effect that's just caused by the proper motion causes an apparent change in the period derivative. So there's pretty much four terms that can affect what we measure. And this is just a diagram just to show, if we're over here observing this cluster, and the pulsar is behind the cluster, the acceleration is going to pull it towards us. So if that's the dominant effect, we're going to see a negative acceleration of that pulsar, and we'll actually see some pulsars that appear to spin faster over time. So they'll appear to be spinning up. And in fact, Fernando mentioned it in his talk, about over half the pulsars in 47 Tuck show this effect, and they very nicely were able to use using a model of the cluster and to watch these accelerations to model where they thought the pulsars were in three dimensions, and then determine the gas content of the cluster. So there's a couple other things you can do with the period derivative. You can determine what you think the maximum acceleration is, and there's a couple different ways to do that, but this is the acceleration curve. So this would be the maximum values, and it occurs at some radial or distance either towards or away from you from the cluster. And you can, Finney showed you can, there's a couple ways you can calculate that, and one of them is by using the central velocity dispersion that you measure in the optical. And so if you calculate it this way, you can use the measured value to constrain the intrinsic spin down of the pulsar, which lets you constrain the magnetic field, the ages, and the E-dot of the pulsar. And also, by also looking at the maximum acceleration that you measure, if it's negative, if that acceleration is negative, so it's the dominant term, you can constrain the cluster potential and calculate the mass-to-light ratio within the projected pulsar's position. So M13 has allowed us to do some interesting things with this. M13 is a relatively low-density cluster, and it was a big surprise when the first pulsar was discovered in this. There was a Nature paper written, and it was like, hey, this is a very low-density cluster. How are pulsars being produced here? There shouldn't be any pulsars here. Well, now we have four, and there's a lot of scintillation in this cluster. I expect that it wouldn't be unlikely for us to find one or two more. But two of them were known a while ago, a binary and an isolated pulsar, M13A and B. We've just determined the timing solution for B about 3 weeks ago. It never had a timing solution before. And you can see it's outside the half-mass radius, which is only one of a couple of the pulsars that are like that. So that's kind of unusual. And another unusual thing about that pulsar is that it has its measured spin down is virtually zero. So those four terms are almost completely canceling each other to unnaturally high precision. So we're still trying to figure out what exactly that means. Then the other pulsars, the new pulsars that we have are M13C, which is an isolated pulsar, and D, which is the closest pulsar to the cluster. And D is a binary with a 14-hour binary and a slight amount of eccentricity that we can very accurately measure. So by using the negative period derivatives of A and D, we can and their relations to the core, we can actually use D, which gives a more constraining mass-to-light ratio, but it's at least two within the projected from D to the center of the core. So relatively consistent with what we know about globular clusters and what we would predict. Then if we turn this around and use the maximum possible acceleration to constrain the pulsar parameters, we also can find some interesting things. First off, these pulsars, all of them, are old. They're at least 2 to 4 billion years old, which is different from most of the other pulsars that are measured in cluster. When you try to infer their ages, they tend to work out often an order of magnitude less than this. So for some reason, these pulsars seem to be old. Very weak magnetic fields on the lower end, a few times 10 to the 8 Gauss of what you typically see with MSPs, which are about, you know, a few times 10 to the 8 up to a few times 10 to the 9. And EDOTs are limited to below about 2 times 10 to the 34. M13D is kind of strange because the acceleration that we measure, which is negative, remember, cannot be explained by the current models of the pulsar. It's too large. It's just plain and simple too large. So if we look at the distance, these are the 1 plus or minus 1 sigma errors of the distance calibrated with a Hipparcos subgiant fitting, a core radii of 38 arc seconds, and a velocity dispersion from Leonard in 92 with this plus or minus 1 sigma. If we look, the pulsar, if we assume a 15 billion year age, the values have to be above this line, pretty much. Okay, and you can get out, there's a sort of slight amount of slop in this. You should fuzz all these lines by a good amount. But in general, if the pulsar is at some reasonable number, it's definitely outside of the plus or minus 1 or 2 sigma error bars of these measurements. So you can get around that by either making the core radius smaller, the distance closer, or the central velocity dispersion higher, or some mix of the three.
Sorry, Scott, isn't that just the same as saying it's at its initial spin?
It's at its initial spin.
What's the question, Scott?
No, because the acceleration that we measure, it's negative, and it's very largely negative. It's too negative to be explained by being dominated by the cluster. Yeah, so really, it's really independent of what its initial spin was, or even its spin down now. Okay, and M30. So M30 is a post-core collapse cluster. Had no known pulsars, very small core radius measured, about 1.8 arc seconds. And there's the half mass radius. We found 2 new binary millisecond pulsars. This is kind of what Brad alluded to. Here we have a very, very dense system. But yet, the 2 pulsars that we found are 11 and 13 milliseconds, much longer than the standard 3 millisecond pulsars. One of those systems we have no idea, we know very little about. It's a very interesting system I'll mention in a second. That's M30B. The other system is that eclipsing millisecond pulsar I showed you in the beginning. And I'd mentioned a few of you in the audience, I thought I had this great new result of a very high mass to light ratio in this cluster. Well, that went away last night. I should say my mistake went away way last night, and now it has a perfectly normal mass-to-light ratio, so I won't mention any more about that. But M30B is an interesting system in itself. This we've seen one time. This is an 8-hour observation taken with the Green Bank Telescope, and very strong detection. It's at least a 30 sigma detection. It's seen in 2 different instruments. We're using 2 instruments in parallel. This thing is definitely real. It has the exact dispersion measure of the other pulsar in the cluster. The problem is we haven't seen it since. We've observed this cluster about 30 times. Now, like Fernando mentioned, this is pretty common in clusters that scintillate a lot. Several of the pulsars in 47 Tuck have only been seen 1 or 2 or 3 times. What we need is another detection or two by some chance. Then we can go back, once we know the orbit, fold all the data and get a good orbital solution. We really want this because by using a technique that Fred and one of his students developed, and the 4 frequency derivatives that we were required to use to make this nice straight line in time, we're able to constrain what the orbit is. We know it cannot be circular. This must have a highly eccentric orbit, and the companion mass must be greater than about 0.4 solar masses. So this could be a highly eccentric it's definitely a highly eccentric system that's going to be showing quite a bit of relativistic effects. And the interesting thing is that it's got a nice sharp pulse, and it's 13 milliseconds. So the timing precision you can do on that to to determine relativistic effects is very good, assuming we can see it again. So we're still working on that. This is, gives you an idea of the families of solutions that are allowed for this system. The eccentricity has to be greater than 0.4. Orbital period is in the few day range probably, and the eccentricity is the companion mass has got to be at least 0.4, and it can easily range up into the 1.4 solar mass range. So we're, matter of fact, this month we have GMRT time, which is a brand new telescope in India, very low frequencies with the sensitivity of Arecibo. We're going to be looking at quite a few clusters, and this is one of our first targets to try to get this guy and to search for new pulsars in M30. So hopefully I'll have something to say about this later on. And that goes right into our future prospects. We have still about 3 terabytes of search data, of data that has not been searched. That takes a lot of work to go through all that. At least 10 new clusters from Arecibo, 6 clusters we haven't gone through very well with GBT. Brian's going to give me some more data on what I have to look through very soon. Lots of data to search. Continue timing these pulsars. Since we now have positions for some of these systems, we're looking for optical and X-ray counterparts. I've already done a very quick peek at M30A and didn't see anything there, but I'm going to have to defer to the experts now and let them look for it. And I mentioned that we're going to be using even much improved systems, even from last year. Arecibo, for instance, has over the last 2 months has quadrupled its bandwidth that we can observe. So now a standard, let's say we can do a 2-hour observation with Arecibo, in the mode that we like to take data, it takes 400 gigabytes of data in a 2-hour observation, but we have very good sensitivity now. So it's pretty nasty. And the GMRT could be a big boon, making a tremendously sensitive observations at 300 megahertz. And so hopefully I have some more stuff to show you. And the last thing I'll leave you with is the cluster M3. We have these 3 pulsars that we've discovered recently, all of them extraordinarily faint. We have confirmed at least 2 of these, and once you confirm them, this one has not been confirmed, but I would say it looks pretty darn good given that we've confirmed the others. Very fast spin periods, we know nothing about them, they're all in binaries. This one looks like it could be eclipsing, so there's a lot more interesting systems that we're going to be finding and hopefully timing over the next few years. Thanks a lot.
The core radio you quoted for M13 and M30. First of all, the M13 one is pretty secure. I don't think it can change very much. It's a 38 arc second core radius. At that sort of radius, it's very difficult to get it wrong. Also, for M30, it's only an upper limit. It's a core collapse cluster. A comment about the M13 pulsar, I guess it was M13B, that's very far out, for which you have 0 acceleration. Is it conceivable that it's been kicked out and it's on a highly eccentric orbit, in which case you'd catch it, most of the time you'd catch it right at the
epicenter. If it has been kicked out and it's in a highly eccentric orbit, you should catch it when it's far out in general, because that's where most of the time is. But the strange thing is that it got kicked out in the right direction, so that the cluster acceleration cancels out those other 3 terms. And it's not 0.
So the cluster has a substantial acceleration of its own.
Even at that radius, even at the half mass radius, there's a substantial contribution.
Finally, something that may sound a bit facetious, in the optical observing queue and service observing, you can specify that you want good seeing if you're in service mode. I'm wondering how quickly you know whether scintillation is helping you or not. How quickly after the observations you know that a scintillation is helping you or not. You would then move on to a different cluster, not waste time on that particular cluster at that time.
Well, most of the clusters, like for instance, the ones with the DMs of in the 20 to 30 range, which a lot of these clusters have, scintillation time scales are of order an hour to, say, 4 hours. So, and you can see that when you look at those time series, you can see how that scintillation changes. So we don't know, we can't do any type of real-time feedback, especially since these pulsars are very weak to begin with. So we got to process our 100 gigabytes of data to see if our very weak pulsar is there to begin with, and then at what signal to noise. So there's no way we can do that in a real-time mode. I really wish there was.
Right. Just wait for the microphone, please.
Just about planning future work. You, assuming that you know the luminosity distributions, the ones you've seen can be extrapolated, and knowing exactly or having a pretty good idea of what's coming in terms of the technology, like this new telescope in India and all that, how long is it going to take before you have another cluster with, say, a sample of 20, 25 pulsars? Is this coming, is this right around the corner?
Well,
or is it still going to be small numbers?
Well, I really do think, and Fernando mentioned this, that right now everything is consistent with the fact that we're just touching, for a lot of these clusters, we're just touching the top of the luminosity distribution. So what I'm guessing you're going to see is every time there's a substantial upgrade to a telescope or to any type of data processing capability, you're going to see new pulsars coming out of the same clusters. It's tough to say on the low-density clusters how much, you know, maybe we are actually, especially the close ones, maybe we are running into some kind of, we've done some kind of relatively complete sample. But on the dense clusters that are relatively far away, I really do think every time there's going to be a telescope upgrade, you'll see a few more pulsars. And that will probably go on for this, at least through the square kilometer array, which if it ever gets built.
I would just say, for 6266, I think there's a good chance that with proper computing power, can reduce long tracks from Green Bank, and already there are 6 pulsars known, and I think there are lots of them there to be had. So that would be my best guess for the next 47 talking quotes.
Any more questions? Yeah, Lars?
Can you tell us, for example, in M3 or these other, some of these, what really is your frequency sensitivity? Are you seeing something like what's seen in 47 talk where there's nothing below 2 milliseconds? Does that have meaning or not?
Yes, it definitely does have meaning. Right now, our search sensitivities, we're very sensitive to pulsations at least down to a millisecond. If it's a bright pulsar, we could get a little bit better. I hate quoting sensitivities because as you go faster and faster in period, the selection effects get much, much worse, and it's very hard to quantify. But we definitely can detect, say, 1 to 1.5 millisecond pulsars quite easily. And they're just not there. At least they're not the strong ones, that's for sure.
Right. For those of you who were not born yet in 1982, I would like to add a historical note. That is that the Ali Alpar paper did not only... I would have thought that my paper carries far enough. But
thank you. So for those of you who were not born in 1982, the Ali Alpar paper had a big impact, not only on the radio people, as we've heard from both speakers, who then, because Ali Alpar made the connection between the low-mass X-ray binaries and the millisecond radio pulsars, the recycling process, so that all millisecond pulsars, radio pulsars, had to go through an LMXB phase earlier on, they were spun up. Not only did the radio people then start to look in globular clusters to find more of these millisecond pulsars, but for us radio astronomers, it was a reason to believe that indeed the neutron stars in low-mass X-ray binaries might actually spin at the frequency in milliseconds. And some of us have dedicated decades of our lives to finding them, and they were found. We now know that indeed neutron stars in low-mass X-ray binaries, many of them spin in the range of milliseconds. So this Ali Alpar paper of 1982 had a big impact not only in your field but also in our field. So I may have used up all your time now, I'm sorry. Oh, Lars?
I'm still trying to understand the constraints on PDON. I mean, we would really like to know what are the implied magnetic fields for these systems. And so unlike in the field where the PDOT means something, you know, here it's complicated by the cluster potentials. So could you give us some sense of, now that you're sampling so many different clusters, where I presume the acceleration numbers are different, I mean, at some point I would hope that you would be able to really start saying PDOT of the pulsar for some of these is less than something and the B fields are less than some number with standard magnetic spin.
Right. Well, that's one reason I focused on M13, because looking at the other pulsars, which with two of the clusters, M5 and M71, I'm not confident enough yet in my PDOT measurement. We don't even have a year yet of timing on those. So it's tough to measure a PDOT in under a year. But for M13 and M30A, For instance, M38, if you look at the constraints on magnetic field and age, there it's not constraining at all. It says the age is greater than about a couple times, maybe a 10 to the 1 times 10 to the 8 years or something like that. Well, that's pretty, it seems like that'd be pretty obvious. The magnetic field is going to be less than 5 times 10 to the 9 Gauss. And so it's unconstraining, so I didn't even mention it. But yes, with a much larger sample, and if we can get a better way, a believable way, of modeling the clusters, like, and figuring out using median or average positions of the pulsar in the radial direction, you could start to say something, and this is what happened in the 47 Tuck timing papers, about in general what the period derivative, not what they are, but it's going to be statistical for sure.
Yeah, go ahead.
Just to follow up to that question, Lars, I would say that, well, there's a few cases where the pulsars are located far enough out from the cluster, some millisecond pulsars, and in those cases they're not affected by acceleration, and they are old, a few billion years old, really. I would say there's no evidence that most millisecond pulsars in clusters, that any of them essentially are young or youngish. They're old.
Right. Yeah. But I guess what I was saying is that it looks like, I mean, given the theory of the binary interactions, a lot of them were probably produced, there's production going on throughout the history of the cluster probably, in the dense clusters. It's not necessary that all the MSPs were produced 12 billion years ago, and we're seeing them now, but there's definitely probably some age spread of where they are produced.
Last question, Fred.
So the big message here, I mean, just look at what's up there. 2 milliseconds, 2 milliseconds, two mm-hmm. milliseconds.
Yeah, that's interesting.
There's absolutely no nuclear physics that gets you anywhere near this number. You know, they're all, you know, if you start thinking about equation of state, you're down half a millisecond, 1 millisecond. Mm-hmm. So people who think about accretion really need to think hard about what sets this number.
It's been solved, Fred. It's a prediction. We need to catch up.
Post-diction. All right. Thank you very much, Doc. The next